that fraction, and you can come on out to the Heroes Con and meet me and the guys from the Dollar Bin. We're going to be hanging out and rocking it Charlotte style. Come see us.
All right, guys, so we want to welcome everybody to the Iron Man, Invincible Iron Man discussion group. This is going to be a little bit different than the other ones. You know, we've had, like, a lot of very, very, really deep, you know, challenging pieces of comic where there were obviously many multi-layers. I don't know if there was as many multi-layers in this, but I really found it a real high-quality piece of mainstream comic books. And I wanted to talk a lot about what worked and what didn't. Now, what I'd like to do is, if it's all right with you guys, I'd like to, and again, Bat Fraction is supposed to be, I've not spoken with him, but he's just a terrific guy. He used to work here in the store, and what I'd like to do is cover while we're talking here for the first half hour or so about maybe issues you guys may have had with the book. Challenges with the art, challenges with the story, or maybe you didn't have any. But this is the time I'd like to cover it. Now, the other thing, I'll throw a few topics at you guys, and what I'd like to do is bring up what we want to discuss. Now, the main thing is, in the past, I've come out with both guns blaring because I've read the book 8 or 9 times, and I've got a list of things, and I want to tell you guys my reading on it. I've got a reading on it, but this is going to be more along the lines of I had not really read a Marvel comic in almost 15 years. All right? In fact, and this is ironic, but I'm not making this up. When I was a rabid collector, I was reading 20 to 40 titles a month. Okay, this was even back around 88, 89. One of my favorites was Iron Man. And I read the David Michelinie, Bob Layton, which is very much kind of the thing that set the tone for Iron Man pretty much to this day. And that started Tony Stark on his alcoholism. And then after they left, you know, you're like, the book will never be the same. Well, Denny O'Neill took over with an artist named Luke McDowell. Or McDonald. It's been so long, I don't know. But they really did this terrific, long, like, 2-year storyline where Tony Stark fell into alcoholism. The company got taken over by Obadiah Stane. At that point, Secret Wars 2 started up, and there were just too many crossovers, and I got fed up and pretty much quit reading comic books. So how ironic. I pick up this book, and it's a virtual direct sequel to the last Iron Man story I ever read. No, this was way before Armor Wars. This would have been literally, I think, more along the lines of...
Well, right. the stuff was saying that Stane's kid in the book, but the Armor Wars was... I guess it's a combination, too. Armor Wars after that was basically people hijacking his tech
to do all sorts of things.
So Fraction's Run is kind of like a sequel to both.
Okay.
Because somebody's using his tech and in Stane's offer.
Terrific. So the main things I want to cover is I want you guys to help fill me in on some things. And then again, I'm going to throw a few things at you that, again, I think I saw. And if you disagree, tell me, because I'm as full of it as the next guy, but I talk louder than everybody else, so people think, hey, maybe this guy knows what he's talking about. Now, here's some topics I'd like to discuss. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Before we get to that, with Matt Fraction, I'm going to ask the first one or two questions, but I want you guys, don't be afraid to talk to him, all right? You got questions for him? I'll ask you at the beginning, try to keep it to Iron Man, but if you want to ask about Iron Fist, you want to ask about other things, terrific. But the key for me is going to be, I want to challenge him on a couple of questions on issues that I had with the book that I want him to address. Secondly, I saw a substantial amount of imagery you may agree or disagree with, and I want to know if he intended it, or am I making it up, or am I reading too much into it? The other thing I'd like him to talk about is everybody in this room would have liked to have at one point or the other written or drawn a comic book, correct?
Yeah, sure.
I would sure like him to give us a couple of bullet points on how we got from here to there. The hard work, I want to hear the rags to riches emphasis on rags. I want to hear about the things it took. The other thing I want to know about is, what's it like doing a team book? You know, he had to deal with an editor, he had to deal with a letterer, he had to deal with the colorist. We're so used to picking up the product, I want to hear at least a little bit about what it took. How close was this to his real vision? All right. Now, on that note, some of the things I'd like to discuss now, and again, we'll feel free to pick off the list, or we can talk about something else. But topics I'd like to talk to is, what was the deal with the Pepper Potts subplot, with her getting basically blown up? Why is it in there? What prompted Tony Stark to treat Pepper like dirt at the party? Did the static artwork help or hinder the story? What I'm suggesting in that is, The gentleman, I think, had two different styles. One for when we're seeing the artwork or seeing the action from outside of Tony Stark's helmet, and other times where it's Tony's point of view, and I think you're looking at it from a computer-generated image, because he's obviously not looking with eyes, he's looking at a monitor. Does Tony Stark come off as a realistic alcoholic? How effective was the seventh issue? And I really want to get into that in a lot of ways. Can we relate to the man inside the armor? Hey, I don't know about you guys, I'm out of a job. These guys, they're throwing around the word billions. And after a certain point, do you kind of, we're all here because it's a fantasy, but do you feel a disconnect at a certain point? Or was Matt Fraction able to connect with the reader? How is this different? How is Matt Fraction's Iron Man different from the presentation of Iron Man and the other Marvel monthly books? That's something I'd like you guys to tell me and discuss. Who are all the guys in armor in issue one? The ones that Tony Stark is constantly watching. I looked at him and I went, oh, nice drawing. Why on earth? This one's for Daniel. Why does Tony Stark still go around in the armor when it's apparent from issue six that he no longer actually has to be in the armor most of the time? Was there enough action in the story for you guys? Has the series improved since the first arc? What did Peter Parker do for Stark Industries? Why is part six titled Irrational Actors? How can Peter Parker have a spider tracker and webbing that no one can figure out the technology on? I'd like to discuss how Iron Man humanized the story better than any of the victims could have. Shouldn't Tony Stark have been able to pick up at the end on who took the photo? And finally, Zeke Stane's t-shirt. Who knows what it's an homage to? It's basically Captain America with a bullet hole in his chest, or in his forehead, and it said basically, Tony was right. We'll start with that one, because I actually caught that one.
Franklin's been selling, he hasn't been selling it, but he's had on his webpage an iron-on that you can do with that image on it for a while now.
But does anybody know where it's from? I'm so proud of myself. I got one thing. No?
No. Wait, as far as like that sort of style of shirt?
Basically, it's a takeoff on a very clever idea in a Grant Morrison book.
New X-Men, though. They did Magneto Was Right, though, and it was brought up with some of the kids.
All right. So on that note, out of all those topics, what do you guys want to jump on? What do you guys want to approach?
I'd say you just give us a starting point, because that's a lot of stuff.
I threw out a million, and you guys take one.
Tony Stark a realistic alcoholic?
Yeah. Is he?
Well, he's recovering, so. Well, did he drink, like, liquor, or was he a beer man?
I don't know.
No.
Because that alcoholic, I don't know.
With some alcoholics, at least from what I understand, sometimes it's not so much about what's actually in it, so much as it's alcohol. I mean, who watches The Office here?
Oh, yeah, Melanie.
Yeah. Oh, yes, where she takes a hand sanitizer and just dumps it on her tongue.
True. All right, I'm going to, again, I don't care if I'm on tape. Most people that know me, I say it proudly. I am a recovering alcoholic. I have been for over 20 years. In fact, I quit drinking right around the time that Tony Stark quit drinking, honestly. Was the book part of a wake-up call? I want to say romantically, sure. But here's the question, though, for you. Remember how they set up the first storyline, the first issue, and there were the five things, there's five... Mm-hmm. Big concerns. Right. Did you feel them the rest of the book?
Yeah.
You did?
Not everyone.
Or did you feel as if Tony Stark, pretty much every page, alcoholism, sometimes it's no problem, sometimes you've got to go day by day, sometimes you have to go minute by minute.
I think the problem with him is that even though he is supposed to be a recovering alcoholic, he still has to fake it for his persona. So he still has to be Mr. Party Guy and pretend that he's out partying and all of that. And that's a little different than what most people would have to deal with. Most people would be able to just stay home and not be a billion-dollar playboy.
So the Marvel world at large does not know he's an alcoholic?
Yeah, I would guess that that's not common knowledge, because that would hurt his stock and all of that kind of stuff.
Would he have been made? When did he become the head of? When did he become the head of
Shield?
Shield.
Shield. So,
at the end of the war.
Civil War.
He's not wrong.
Yeah, you missed an entire huge crossover.
Yeah. Okay.
Welcome.
Well, I think I was
not very well. The reason why the end of, I thought the end of this worked, especially that one image we were talking about, the photo at the end, is because he had so much on him at this point with Civil War and everything else that happened. He's not a very well-liked character at this point.
All right, then let me ask you guys this. Again, I know this is a comic book. We're talking about superheroes, and we have to suspend our disbelief. But did anybody have suddenly a little trouble at all with how much was on his plate?
You mean how much he was multitasking when he's like running 40 Ironmen and running Shield and running a company and all that?
Running Shield and running a company. And still, and being a superhero at the same time.
Well, wasn't that kind of the point? I mean, remember he's playing chess with Reed Richards and they both got five boards going.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Chess all five at once. It seemed like it was almost to underscore that point that he's not only able, but maybe thrives on that kind of intense. Whatever the word.
Maybe he needs it.
Now, question for you. Where were they playing chess? Were they playing chess at Fantastic Four? Were they playing chess at Iron Man's place?
They were playing chess at Iron Man's
place.
No, I know
that's
playing
Iron Man's the one that gets up and leaves.
That's a good point. That's very good.
But I'm wondering if Tony cheated.
There you go. Oh, I'm sure he would cheat regardless.
Anything to win.
No matter where he was, no matter who he was playing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're all kind of, you know, we one of the ones we did earlier was Batman Year One. And he's not really the Batman of later years where, you know, you're questioning whether he's, you know, sane or insane or what have you. But the thing that was throwing me is, you know, is Tony Stark likable?
No.
Yes.
He can be, but he's not at this point because of the Superhero Registration Act and everything that happened in the Civil War.
Well, he
siding against Captain America.
He didn't like him within the confines of his own.
And Jerry Blaine death of America.
And I apologize, I didn't hear what you said.
They generally blamed, I think, for the death of Captain America.
Exactly.
They blame him for his death because it's because of his taking a stance for registration that splits the heroes down, which leads to Captain America's arrest, which leads to him being assassinated. So ultimately, he's the starting point. Everyone blames him for everything that's gone wrong.
All right.
Yeah.
And he has to deal with that.
Matt Fraction said one of his goals in writing Invincible Iron Man was to make Tony a likable character again.
And here's all I'm going to suggest to you guys. Is it possible to have sat down and read 7 issues of a book where 80%, and I pulled that right out of my rear end, but 80% of it is being told from his point of view. Mm-hmm. Are you really able to read that book if you really dislike the character?
Yes, because you could be interesting and not likable.
Well,
that's possible. Okay, I'm...
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I guess the way I see it, though, is if some people really have that intense dislike for him, they're probably going to come out and just hit him anyway. I mean, taking another comic example with One More Day and Brand New Day, people are like, well, what I've noticed with some of the entitled, you know, Brand New Day people, though, is like, oh man, they ruined the marriage, just not going to be good, they're going into this and that and the other, though. But if there's a slight dislike, then yeah, sure, I could kind of see that, you know, maybe being convinced of like, well, you know, maybe he doesn't suck that much.
All right, well, forgive me. And again, guys, this is the beauty of comics. You know, I want to emphasize to everybody, I don't read mainstream comics, but I get it. You know, and I read mainstream comics for years, and I had thousands and thousands, and I had long boxes. But everything I've heard from almost all of you guys so far is you're responding as if you are a member of the Marvel Universe. And that's fine.
How do you know about us?
All right, but my point is this. I want to look at how the quality of Matt Fraction's writing, that he was able to guide us through this story arc up to that very heartfelt coda at the end, and he was able to do it with a character that you guys seem to inherently dislike.
Well, I don't think it's just a couple guys that said they thought it was like.
Well, more important than just having a likable hero is that you have a really good villain, and this story, I had a nice villain for it.
Oh, yes.
Because it was... Yeah, you're not going to get very far in a story if you don't have a good villain. All heroes are essentially copy and paste, but it's the villain that has to be unique to the story. And... That's what I think is always most important.
It's interesting you said that, because like one of the things I was going to point out, the one complaint I had was that I felt nothing towards the villain. So like in a lot of cases, any tag on thing, any character could have built it.
Oh, because he was like that son that hates him because of his dad.
It just didn't seem like anything around me. Nothing really stood out about him in particular. For me, like the big thing for me was that this was the first book I did, like Tony Stark. That held up, but that was the weak spot, I will say.
I'm a tip. Book. I don't like Tony Stark. I don't like Iron Man at all.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed reading the, I heard you say the thing about if you don't like Iron Man, could you enjoy the book because it's first person? But I don't like Iron Man, and I think I might have liked Iron Man more at the end because it was first person. So he forced to think about his decisions and stresses and all that sort of, you know, he's basically a big weapons dealer, but he's also a scientist. He's also on some level a philanthropist and all that stuff.
Is it possible that you two guys liking him for the first time is some backwash in the movie, too?
I haven't seen the movie.
You didn't see the movie?
I got burned by pay-per-view today. I was going to sit down and watch it because I wanted to make it, and I couldn't get it. But how about this, though? You know, again, I sat down and read this as unto itself. You know what I mean? This was a story arc. I know enough about Iron Man, but still, I don't know. I know that there was a civil war. I know because the Captain America was killed. But let me ask you this. I sat down with my wife. She was feeling sorry for me because I'm out of work. And she watched X-Men, the first X-Men movie. And bear with me a sec. Her jaw dropped. She's like... Everybody's an Academy Award winner. I'm like, yeah, it's a pretty decent movie. The first X-Men movie. Now, this is, again, somebody who didn't know anything about X-Men. She's watching it. And an interesting point, guys. I am not a conservative. I'm more liberal. The broker I get, the more liberal I get. All right? No, I mean, you hit a certain age, you buy a house, you have a kid, you start to get a little more conservative. I know that's a real sweeping generalization, but it's kind of true. All of a sudden, you're like... I want that tax break. You know? I don't want the bad guys anywhere near me. I'm sure you're good over there, but not here. Okay? My point, when I was watching the X-Men and Jean Grey was up in front of the UN, I sat there and said, yeah, I do want every mutant. I want to know exactly what's going on with every mutant. I don't want to, you know, again, I there's the Nazi parallel and everything, absolutely, but I just sat down and said, I wanted that. So to me, the Civil War kind of made sense. I didn't read any of the issues. But again, I'm just saying, from an outsider, it made sense.
It was, the Civil War narrative itself pushed you to root for the resistance, I think. And I think that what Invincible Iron Man did was it put like a subjective view on Tony that we hadn't gotten in 2 or 3 years in any real substantial manner. And I think that's what makes Invincible Iron Man work, is that you've got to return to that level of subjectivity. And before, he was just like this government spook boogeyman kind of guy. And all of a sudden, now he's relatable and he's a human being again.
But he's the same jerk that slept with the Wasp when Yellowjacket was in prison.
He's a jerk.
Yeah. Yeah. Slept with the Wasp. Nobody's perfect. He's always been a really, really flawed character.
Yes,
he's
indeed.
A billionaire.
Just like me.
Exactly.
Well, the difference with Stark being a jerk, though, is he's the kind that doesn't have a problem with his jerkiness. He makes no apologies for being that much of an ass.
There is something said.
Exactly, like me.
You have a certain respect for somebody who just like out
there. Well, there's the money, too. When you have that much money, you don't have to apologize for it sometimes.
You can buy and sell
yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, at least he's not like Bruce Wayne. Works. He actually works at being a billionaire, not like Bruce
that
Wayne
is
just old money.
Yeah.
But how much of it, though, was, again, Matt's a damn good writer. And
God bless you.
First time I read it through, I read it as a really intriguing terrorist story. More than a superhero story. I felt so involved. I felt inside the armor, like as if I was more inside of a jet than as opposed to a superhero. And Lisa, again, that's the way I felt. Then I got to the seventh issue, which again, we'll talk about a little bit. And I read it a second time, and all of a sudden the seams to me started to show. Because I don't read superhero comics anymore. So the seams to me were showing. Here's the ones that threw me, and tell me what you think. You talk about Tony Stark, his heart's in the right place. I think he's running the entire world. He's only telling us what we want to hear. It's his narrative. That's one. Two, he sat there and watched, again, guys, I don't know about you, but that was the biggest body count I've seen in comic books since Miracle Man number 15. How many people died in this book? They wiped out an entire group of superheroes. He wiped out, Tabora is a real town. You know, I mean, he made it as realistic as possible, tried to make you feel for him, but then at the end, he's feeling remorse because he inadvertently killed four people who were going to kill everybody anyway.
Right, who were suicide bombers. And he was much more concerned about Pepper being in the wreckage than the 58 people or whatever that died.
It shows his human side.
And we find that out the next issue as an old matter of fact. Remember, he explains over the course of two pages. This many people, there was a staff, this piece, and so everybody had to have died. Except for Pepper, I saved her. And then he mentions, casually, 58 people.
I think the thing for me with Stark that matches that is, to me, he's not a hero because he has any sort of need or desire to be someone that does something for someone else. It's because he thinks he needs to be because of how great he is. So what affected him was his personal failings off of that, not the great loss of life, because he's not in it for that. He's in it to be awesome.
I disagree with that.
Invincibly awesome.
Tony Stark and Iron Man's whole thing is a redemptive arc. His father was a weapons manufacturer. He was a weapons manufacturer until what happened to him in Vietnam or Iraq or whatever.
He went right back to building weapons, though.
He didn't. He stopped being a weapons
manufacturer. What do you call being the head of
S.H.I.E.L.D.? They make a point of that in the book.
What do you call being the head of S.H.I.E.L.D. and all of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s tech being Stark?
It's a preventative organization.
How'd that work out for him?
Wow, you guys are having sparks. I love it.
Speaking of Tony's origin, like he got the shrapnel removed from his heart so that he doesn't need to have the magnetic resonator piece in his chest.
He doesn't need to be Iron Man.
Right, but in here in this issue, it has a picture of him with the same glowing chest piece that Pepper has.
Yeah,
so what is that?
He had the shrapnel removed, but that doesn't mean he had his little
like,
Iron
see,
Man.
See, right there, through his shirt, like...
The miniature art from the movie.
Right. In the first issue, though, I looked at the first three issues before this. In my heart, I know that's because without the Iron Man, I honestly wouldn't know what to do with myself. I guess he just does it, though, because he couldn't really see himself do anything else.
I might also point out, too, that Matt's a pretty smart guy, and I would not put it past him to have written those kind of subtle flaws into Tony Stark's character. For instance, I mean, it struck me as pretty glaring that he's like, Pepper. And he goes after her and he's like, I shouldn't have said that dumb thing at the party. And now, look, six people got killed in a giant bomb and I'm in the middle of Taipei or whatever. And he casually tosses off 60 people dying. That might have been, it'd be easy to compare that to the actions of a lot of recent CEOs. How dare the government put limits on our compensation when we cost many people half their savings or retirement or whatnot?
And the stuff with Pepper is going to continue to play out in the book, too. So.
And I have to say it, the way I was trying to read it, and I haven't read a comic book in a long time, and things used to move a lot faster back in the Roy Thomas.
They're just now getting
okay, and that's fairly obvious. But the thing is, though, what did you guys think, though? Let's forget for a minute that this is a monthly book. I know it's impossible. But
I mean, I'm really
really how everybody is. You know, if you got someone who's hurt, regardless, you kind of focus on that person that's hurt, regardless of who else is around, because you know that person. You have an emotionally invested in, you know, investment in that person. So that's, I mean, that's a very human side to himself. So I think that's, you know, it's kind of easy to condemn Tony for that, but it's a human nature thing.
I could see Spider-Man doing the same exact thing that normally does when it comes to Spider-Man. It's like, oh yeah, Aunt May, or oh yeah, Mary Jane. Normally, though, if there's something where they're in danger, he's more likely going to, and there's another choice where there's so many other people, he's more likely going to choose the relative. Just because there always seems to be that such emotional attachment between Peter Parker and people.
I need to make a deal with the devil.
Mary Jane was there too, making the deal.
Hey, I have a question about that, because that confused me with Spider-Man.
Let it go, it happened.
Hold on a sec. The brand new day, deal with the devil thing, like, I'm not real clear on that, so. Well, no, I know it's reviled and all that, but I'm just asking for narrative clarity. Like, so.
Forget everything you knew about Spider-Man in the last.
No, the whole Civil War unmasking didn't happen.
Did not happen.
Tony Stark doesn't know who Spider-Man is.
Some of the stuff from Civil War happened, but it didn't happen the way you read it.
Nobody knows
Spider-Man.
Spider-Man.
From what I understand,
he lifted up his mask and
he lifted up his mask and nobody can remember who it is.
That's what they've said, yeah. Which is not very feasible either.
Just throw out your entire collection from the very
turn time back, the more that he just kind of
hit. He just wiped everybody's mouth.
Everything. Right.
But I want to get to 7 in a minute. I'm sorry.
Okay, sorry. No. That confused me.
The whole Pepper Pot subplot, I saw it more superficial reading. I saw Invisible Iron Man as kind of like a restart for Golem. And this is like kind of building off of the movie.
I agree with Sean, for sure.
And that is the whole reason.
And that's why Stain was the villain. Just so they didn't have a guy named Stain in the book to tie in with the movie.
Yeah.
I'm just mad about that because I heard they did those kind of concurrently.
I heard that he started writing the book
and kind of was like, oh, cool.
Well, Stain actually showed up in the last few issues of The Order, which he also did.
I feel like that doesn't mean he didn't know what was going on in the movie.
Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, he probably knew something about it, but it was kind of like a happy
accident. I mean, honestly, if Marvel was smart, then they should have steered him in that way. Because you want people to come to the movie theaters, unlike, you know, like DC with Batman. You couldn't go from the theater and buy anything that resembled a real Batman story at that time. You couldn't go into a store except for Hero. But with Iron Man, you could go and pick up Fractions, which was kind of a sequel, and you could pick up the Jon Favreau book when it came out.
It's not going to finish.
When it came out.
I wouldn't think so.
Apparently the internet feedback was bad, so he just dumped it.
Good job, Kevin.
He wussed out.
If only Kevin Smith would learn that way.
You're only saying that.
Well, there goes your Kevin Smith.
Is that normally they have these creators plan stuff out about a year, year and a half in advance. And I think I heard about Fraction with Drew Baker playing. I heard something where it's like they got together and they started to work out a little bit on the X-Men stuff. You know, about a year or two in advance. So, I mean, if they hear Iron Man movies coming down the pipe, we could do something with that.
And Marvel has those big creative summits where they throw as much stuff against the wall as they can get. So,
all right, if you guys can bear with me a minute, again, I don't want to belabor it because again, this isn't about me. This is about this arc of the book. But did anybody read the Michelini or the Denny O'Neill story arcs?
Read some of that stuff. Yeah.
The only other thing I read was Exterminus, just because they kept talking about the armor and.
That's a good trade too.
The reason why this was so good was literally the book, month after month, and sales dropped because they were pretty much letting Denny O'Neill. He was still kind of a hot commodity. It was just the pre Alan Moore era. So Denny O'Neill was still like kind of the big name, and they let him do whatever. And I mean, it was played out like a chessboard, and all the villains were the Bishop and the Knight and everything like that, and. At the end, after Tony Stark had been completely wrecked, and he's just upset as can be, he goes back to his apartment, sits down, looks up, and there's a bottle of open liquor sitting right there on the table. You know what I mean? Like, and no one around. So, there, before you know it, he's in the gutter. My point was,
literally.
Obadiah Stane was such a tremendous villain. They really took the time. It warranted to me this. But let's get now to the Son for a minute. You mentioned, I agree with you on that. Indiana Jones movies, Star Wars, no matter what you want to do, Harry Potter, it all comes down to the villain. James Bond is the perfect example. If it's a good one, if it's a good one, it really works. The only times, again, I started to see the theme show, and I want to know what you guys think. The meeting with the cigarette growers, the cigarette manufacturers, at the beginning when you first meet Ezekiel Stane. Did that work for you guys?
That was just a political thing. I think he was just using a terrorist to give his own opinion. Matt's own opinion on cigarette companies, I think. But that whole line, I'm a terrorist, and I'm telling you guys you're evil. It seemed kind of labored.
But was it labored, or was it trying to show him as a 19-year-old kid? Perhaps.
I don't know, he's too many 19-year-old kids.
Maybe a bit
tell
of both.
A cigarette CEO
Marvel shoving their cigarette stands in your face while showing him to be a 19-year-old kid.
Yeah, it seemed pretty heavy-handed.
Yeah. It just seemed like we're going to take time out from this comic book to give you a Surgeon General warning or something.
Marvel's been quietly doing that for 3 or 4 years, though. So.
Thank you, Joe.
That's what.
Wolverine don't smoke.
So did this lay flat to you guys, or were you just able to kind of blow by it?
I was able to blow by that one.
Yeah.
I thought the villain, I might be the only one in the room, I thought the villain was flat the whole time.
That's right,
you said that earlier. Yeah. To me, the arc wasn't about the villain. It was about the beginning of Stark's life crumbling down, which is what we're getting in the book now. So I wasn't interested in the villain as much as the stuff that Stark was going through.
Okay, so Stark is starting to hit rock bottom.
Right.
That brings me to me, and I think this is... Well, okay, if you guys can bear with, here's the things I don't want to bring up to Matt. I really thought the cigarette scene was real, or the cigarette company... was badly handled. And then I had thought that the very ending of issue 6, mind you, I thought when I was reading it that issue 6 was the last issue we were reading. Yet I wasn't like paying attention. I was like, oh, this is the end of the story? And I was like, why does he care about these poor people? You know, why is he feeling so sad? Why didn't he just kill Ezekiel? Did anybody feel any empathy for Ezekiel? When he was beating him up, it was the same thing as beating up MODOK, which I thought MODOK was fired. I thought that was great. But then all of a sudden, so here I am, I'm left, and it seemed like such a heavy-handed ending. And I was really disappointed. You know, all of a sudden and this is where I'll ask you to bear with me for a minute. Suddenly my disbelief was gone. I sat down and said, and I did the exact same thing during Batman Year One. I sat there and said, this is so good, so realistic. Why does he have to dress up as a bat? Why isn't he building companies and getting all the hookers and the pimps off the street and giving them jobs? You know, and I'm saying, I was serious. The book really tried to challenge you that way, and that's what I wanted. So what I'm saying to you this way is, you cannot tell me that the largest conglomerate on Earth goes dormant for, what, probably a month because of the electromagnetic field and all the damage it did. That should have destroyed the economy. And he did all that just to prevent not killing 4 guys?
Well, so some of the Marvel stuff you're not reading continues along that same line with throwing all of their eggs in the one Stark basket and then not showing the repercussions of it.
How about 10 minutes? Is everyone good for that? Because I do want to talk about, we're getting to the 7th issue right now.
Okay.
All right, I've got you on that. But again, I suddenly sat there and my disbelief ran out. This is just me reading. I don't have to be right. You know, you guys can, I didn't read the next arc. But boy, and this I want to credit Matt Fraction with. I really want to. And the reason, what got me, was the absolute success. And I don't think there was a wrong note in issue 7.
That's because you haven't read Civil War.
What do you?
Well, I think that some of this issue would have been a lot more kind of poignant and personal and tied more together.
Oh, okay.
Iron Man loses Spider-Man.
Thank you.
Yeah,
they had a great relationship. They had a weird father-son dynamic. They had a great relationship when they knew when each other were and everything, when they were living together in Avengers.
And it felt like it was written when they knew each other, and then they had to try to make it where they
did. Issue 7 was as good as he could possibly make it with the handcuffs that Brand New Day put on that entire company.
But bear with me. Without the baggage, and this is what I'm just suggesting to you guys, words on paper, what that issue was, to me, was an absolute masterful success. We just came off of a 6-issue terrorist thing where how many thousands of people died? Our hero ends up 3/4 of the way naked, pounding a fist into this guy's face and the blood, right? And we're all a little jaded now, we're used to this. And I came away and went, whoa, that's not what I want out of a superhero comic book. And no, I didn't like Ultimates. I thought Ultimates went too far in this deep, dark, nitty-gritty. I want hope. That's all I ask for in a comic book. I want a little bit of joy and a little bit of hope. Not much, but some. And that's why I brought up the whole thing about Tony Stark being the main character and not being likable.
And that explains why you don't read a lot of superhero comics anymore.
But after I came out of this, who's the ultimate everyman?
Spider-Man.
I got goosebumps here. Astonishing X-Men number 25. We're on such a huge, everyone read it, I assume? We're on such a huge, galactic scope that you lose something. You've lost kind of what the mutants are about. You've lost Earth. So what does Joss Whedon do in a brilliant shot? Most of the story is told from the point of view of Spider-Man. He is Marvel's ace in the hole. He is the absolute key. So as I'm reading this book, there's this joy of life. And there's the 2 pages that I thought Matt Fraction absolutely nailed it, where basically, without being heavy-handed, Matt Fraction was saying, I'm Spider-Man, I do this, you're Tony Stark, you do that. We both can live together. Come on, it's a team-up. And it felt completely like the old Marvel team-ups. Yeah, they were dumb, kind of overwritten comic books, but I felt this joy. And this joy made me not only want to, I'm ready to read any Spider-Man book that Matt Fraction wrote. Now I'm asking you guys, am I full of it? Is it just because I haven't read a book in a while? Or did you connect? In other words, after this global thing where we're watching mass killers, we're watching a recovering alcoholic stuck in a suit, we're watching a woman who's got this ring put in her chest, we're watching all this stuff, and there's a lot of religious imagery too, which I'll spare you for the moment. And then all of a sudden, it gets so grounded, so back to earth, and the end of the book, to me, ends with Peter Parker's going to win a Pulitzer Prize for that. He should win a Pulitzer Prize for that. And what the ending was reminding us all was that no matter how bad, how bleak things get, there will always be art. And no matter what happens in the future with technology, we'll always have comic books. We've got print and pictures, words and pictures together. That's the last page. You look at it, to me, that's a unifying answer saying comic books will go on, print will go on. And again, it's going to get bleaker, but there's something positive. And I mean, I came away erupted. Now, if you think I'm full of it, let me know.
No, I mean, there's always been this whole comic books are going to die out, then they come back, and they're going to die out, then they come back.
I think to a certain extent you're actually luckier than some of the rest of us, because you didn't know what you were missing with that book or what you wanted to get out of that team up. But it's still I like the series. I'm still buying it. But that's my favorite issue he's done so far. And like I said, it's the best he could have possibly done with the limitations that they gave him with their continuity.
Yeah, I just felt magic in every panel. The artist really stepped it up too. Iron Man looked stoic and rigid like a robot. and Spider-Man was just literally almost moving off the page. That great scene where Spider-Man's hanging upside down and all the goofy stuff that happened with the supervillains. You know, Iron Man knows knocks on your door. What are you going to do? You know, but did any of you feel that, not feel that? This is, to me, real important because, you know, and they also left that part of the story in there. And I thought it was, to me, it was the triumph of art. Peter Parker spent the whole episode trying to connect, and he connected. I thought it was beautiful. I really thought it was that good. But that was just me. I always do that. Around that discussion.
And scene.
I just got it as Matt trying to, like you said, trying to make Iron Man likable again because of what Iron Man kind of put Spider-Man through during Civil War, although it's been kind of negated better New Day. But, I mean, he held Aunt May and MJ captive. I mean, he beat the shit out of Peter. You know, I mean, he did these kind of horrible... He did these kind of like really horrible things, you know, and Spider-Man was like one of the biggest victims of it. And I think it's kind of made Matt's way of saying, hey, Spider-Man's forgiving him. You should too.
If you didn't like One More Day, Tony Stark could have cut him a check to save Aunt May and he wouldn't because he wasn't registered.
Yeah.
So you can blame him as much as Professor.
All right, one other thing real quick. I want to ask everybody, you guys have all, everybody in this room has read a couple of thousand comic books each, right?
Yeah.
And we're used to the grammar of comic books. What do you guys think of the page, the front page being the recap, as opposed to the old way where everything was recapped within the context of the story, which got a little wordy?
I like it.
It makes the story flow better.
Yeah. I can just read the last paragraph half the time and I'm caught up with what I read last year.
And yet, to me, again, I'm just saying this, I noticed one of my favorite scenes in the whole arc was with Reed Richards. And all that really was, even though it really did establish some character, that really was nothing but the recap done over three or four pages. There's no recap in that issue. So I just mean food for thought. I kind of thought Matt Fraction was kind of going, I think I can do this old school. And I thought it was really terrific. Is he,
I texted him, said call 10 minutes.
Okay, how long ago was that?
It's like 7 minutes.
Does anybody have any questions? Or please, people that haven't spoken much, does anybody want to throw anything in?
I want to go back to the old point of why people didn't think he cared about the 60 people who died.
Hey, hold on a second before we go to that point, real quick. Adam, do you have any disclaimers or anything before Matt calls about people speaking into mics, any of that stuff, as far as how it would sound?
It's picking up everything pretty well. I'm going to have to see when I actually have to turn these speakers up to avoid feedback and stuff.
Okay. I am going to ask if it's all right, raise hand. Why? Just because if he hears a bunch of people talking at once, you guys have been on the other end of a conference call tonight.
And feel free to say your name, too.
Yeah, like please.
This podcast, if it's recorded, be like, this is Brian, this is Ronnie, or whatever.
Yeah, and then
if they listen to my podcast, won't they know it's my voice?
They know what?
I said, but if they're listening on my podcast, won't they know
it's
my voice?
Well, they won't know for instance Lee's voice.
When we start talking to him, if he can't hear us, we might have to start walking him, talking directly into the mics, if he can't hear, but that's about it. But it depends on what the phone lines do for us.
Well, I was going to say that the reason I can't see why you wouldn't care that 60 people die and then would go out of his way to save four people from blowing themselves up is, again, that's his entire origin, is that he used to make weapons that killed people and that he had an epiphany that was wrong. And so he spent his life keeping people, disarming the weapons that he made and keeping people from dying. That at the end of the day, he's a superhero. That's what he does. He will do whatever he can to stop people from dying.
But doesn't, forgive me, and this is again, please don't look at, doesn't S.H.I.E.L.D. kill people?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think S.H.I.E.L.D.
S.H.I.E.L.D. protects people.
S.H.I.E.L.D. And but S.H.I.E.L.D. is like
not
S.H.I.E.L.D.
No, they oppress people.
It's not a hammer.
So then before we get mad on, and then the other question, and this brings up to you, because I guess this is being addressed in the next arc, but is Tony Stark at this point ballast? Why isn't he just sending out an army of Iron Men or pawns? Like you. I thought that was pretty obvious. That was his chess. He was playing the chess match, and Ezekiel did not have any pawns. Tony Stark had a ton of them, so because he had the protection and he won.
That goes back to my he's being a hero to be awesome thing. The reason why he still goes out is because he wants to go out and do it.
And he's not director of S.H.I.E.L.D. No, he's out of S.H.I.E.L.D.
But he was then.
There is no S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, they kind of
but he was then.
During
this
story.
Well, it's probably because, like he said, you know, there's no tech support if something goes wrong with the Iron Man suit. He just has to fix it on the fly, and he can't do that remotely from 40 different Iron Man suits. Something, like he said, he's a walking bomb. So all of those suits are walking bombs. If something goes wrong,
that's his thing about he doesn't delegate either. Even when he took over S.H.I.E.L.D., he was out there in the field doing things. He doesn't.
Because he wants to do it.
Well, not only that, but I think that he only trusts himself.
Yeah. He gave Rhodey a suit.
If you scale
that back, if he spent his time getting the right people and making the suit customized to them, he still wouldn't have to go out. He goes out because he needs to go out.
Okay, and
maybe he's addicted to it.
Now I'm going to throw one more thing in about Matt Fraction's writing, and maybe this has been done before by a lot of other Iron Man writers. I don't know, but is anybody anywhere near 40? You don't have to raise your hand, but. All right, back in the day, guys, cars sucked. They did. They were terrible. And you bought a car, an American car especially, and it became yours. You would put a little pencil in I can't think of what the word is. You know how to hot wire your engine, do things. You knew that your car, you had to pull over every 300 miles because it needed more water because there was a constant leak. All right. That said, now today, we all experience it a little bit with our computers, but not quite. Your company computers, you know what I mean? Oh, what's wrong with the network? What's wrong with this? So, no matter what, Tony Stark, to me, with each minute, even though, we don't have weapons, he was the living embodiment of the everyman. It's man every day, guys. It's man versus machine. Our entire life is man versus machine, I think, to the Flintstones. You know what I mean? All the animals always had a gripe, a complaint, a whine, but they kept chewing up the lawn. I honestly think that's one of the things that humanized Tony Stark, and they were able to do that without you noticing. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but again...
Phone's ringing.
Oh.
Oh, wait, no, it's not. That was you talking. I saw a hype. I'm not going to hear it, so we have to be paying attention.
No, but that's why I remember when you were at the beginning working on that.
Yeah.
You know, and it was kind of fun. We're all standing around waiting on tech support, right? And he is tech support. And again, no matter what, you strip that thing away, the Iron Man is nothing but a big computer.
That's the other line.
That's at least what I thought. I'm sorry?
Do you read Ex Machina?
No, I heard it's terrific.
Yeah, does anybody read it?
I read it. That is right.
Yeah, see, so that you'd want to compare those two. Maybe that issue with those two things. But
hello?
Well, would anybody be interested if we Ex Machina as
do we have a fraction?
Yeah, they have tons of trades.
Yeah.
This has been out for a while. We
do have Matt on the phone.
We do.
Let's see.
Can we hear Matt?
We're here. We're trying to get you so we can hear you, Matt.
Say hello like we're a support group. Hi, Matt.
Check, 1, 2.
Hi. Hi, everyone. I'm Andy. Hi. It's been 20 years since my last drink.
God grant me the serenity.
Serenity now! Yeah, okay. The Festivus feats of strength.
Airing the grievances.
Hey, Matt, this is Adam. So far, I'm the only one that can hear you. No one else can hear you yet.
Can we just skip to the feats of strength?
He was talking to me and you couldn't hear me. I'm gonna try to get it up so everybody can hear you, alright?
Alright, hold on.
Oh, right, so what's up with that?
So some of the things, again, I'd like to ask Matt while we're waiting is...
He can't hear you, but...
Right. I know, I'm mentioning this to everybody. Think over your questions again. I'd like to keep it on Iron Man for a little while, but again, anybody wants to ask about Iron Fist, which I thought was just... When I read Iron Fist, that's the way I always dreamed.
What the heck? Okay.
The Phantom was supposed to be. You know, the Phantom in the Daily Comics strip. To me, he was developing this mythology that when he walked away, I was like, this book could run forever. I didn't want to read it anymore because he was off it. Well, again, you know.
All right, now we can hear you now, I think.
Hail Satan. There we go. Oh, yeah, that worked.
Hey, Matt, how are you? Can you hear us okay?
I can hear you great.
Matt, terrific. My name's Andy Mansell. I met you for a couple minutes at Heroes Con, and I just want to thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for asking. Thanks for having me.
We've really enjoyed talking about the book. Some of the things that we basically were discussing was the challenge, and I was wondering if you could just take a minute or two and let us know what you think. We spoke, I think, the majority of the time about how the challenge you must have had, and you did successfully, being inside Tony Stark's head, Tony not being necessarily a likable character, and yet you had to drive the narrative through seven issues, and kind of do a juggling act with the audience, handling a character who may not be that likable, and doing all these heroic or non-heroic things. Was that a challenge for you?
You know, I think I tend to believe that no one is the villain of their own story. So I kind of found Tony likable. maybe the problem is with me. I'm suddenly at a loss for words. How to make someone like Tony, somebody who operates on his level and at his level of intelligence, accessible and human and sort of real to people? Like, how do you kind of let everybody into his decision making process? How to make him a little charming and a little funny and a little dangerous and yet sort of the smartest guy in the room, in a way that doesn't make you feel like he's a fascist or something. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, and I guess the thing is the fact that you weren't able to exactly put it into words, but the fact that you carried it so well throughout the narrative. Again, I really, you know, I'm not trying to pull a Sammy Davis Jr. here, you know, just to sit here and kiss your butt. But I mean, I was really stunned by that.
And thank you. I don't understand how that's a Sammy Davis Jr., but I'll take it.
One of the things people are going to be asking you some questions. One of the things I'd like to do before we let you go, though, is we're a lot of us here are budding writers and artists, and we'd like you to do the old couple of minutes of how you got from this side of the phone to that side of the phone. You know what I mean? Trials, tribulations, what you did, how long it took you to get a script published. Another thing... Oh, I'm sorry.
Sure, sure. Let's see. You know, I was actually with Shelton. When I decided I was gonna, like, that this was something I wanted to do. We were in New York, we were doing a show, and we just had dinner, and I, weirdly enough, I just kind of remember turning to him and going, like, yeah, I'm gonna do this. And he was sort of like, oh, all right, you still gotta drive home. But yeah, weirdly enough, how do you do it? Well, I wrote a lot. That was sort of a big thing for me to realize, was that if I wanted to be a writer, I should probably be writing every day. So that was a big thing. I also found myself falling into traps where I would write about writing an awful lot without doing actually writing. Does that make sense? Like, if there was a quiz or a questionnaire or some sort of poll going on a forum somewhere on the internet about what kind of pens and sketchbooks and notebooks and laptops and programs that I could use, I would love to talk about writing, but there's very little actual writing. That was a big part for me. It was just kind of like, if this is what you're going to do, then you need to do it. You need to do it every day. I kind of ricocheted in, I think, I was doing, I was making animated films out here, like short films. Like, so I was writing, I was producing work, but it was all kind of like film stuff. And I was making sure that comic publishers were seeing it. There was something very graphic and very animated. It was animated stuff, and it was very graphic based and very kind of comic-ish. So I was making sure that comic people were seeing it, and then that kind of got me gigs doing indie work, doing kind of small press stuff, and I just made sure that editors who I liked and respected, and people who could, not to sound too mercenary about it, but pay me to do it for a living, were seeing everything that I did. It was great to meet other writers, and it was great to meet writers, especially who I admired or envied, or artists. Who I've loved, but it was always super important to me to go to shows and meet editors, and to say hi, and to shake hands, and to exchange information, and be able to have people to send work to, just as like a checking in, you know. So I was pinging the radar, however, slightly.
All right, if you don't mind, I'm sorry.
And I got really lucky. That was a big thing too. You have to be like super lucky. So if you can get lucky, that helps.
When you said, and here's just the only granular thing I'm going to do with this. When you said you wrote every day, I assume that meant keeping a journal, but were you writing full scripts? Were you writing, like, plot synopses? Were you...
Those are my dogs. They say hi.
Were you creating characters, or were you saying, no, I want to be a scriptwriter for Marvel or for DC or...
I didn't actually do any Marvel or DC stuff until I was asked to. I was writing stories or writing, you know, essays and articles, or, you know what I mean, sort of academic stuff, or scripts, like film scripts, short film scripts, proposals of my own, pages of my own. I mean, I wrote hundreds of pages that nobody ever saw. Realized the other day there was somebody who was, we almost worked together. We ended up not doing it because of a scheduling issue, but there was a pro who I met at HeroesCon, who I struck up a relationship with HeroesCon, and I, in that sort of naive, hopeful, seen too many movies, looking to get discovered at like the Schwab's milkshake counter kind of way, like sent him a script that I wrote, like, hey, would you want to draw this? Like... woefully inappropriate behavior, but we almost worked together, and I was terrified like he would remember. But I did it. You know what I mean? Like, you have to kind of put yourself out there and take that risk. But yeah, I was just trying to do something every day, trying to work on my craft. Like I said, I wrote hundreds of bad pages of comics that no one will ever see. But it was kind of how I learned to do what I was doing. You know, I would take a story that I'd written, a fictional story or a screenplay, and try to adapt it into a comic, or just to keep your hand moving. You know what I mean? Just, it doesn't matter for me what I'm writing, as long as I'm doing something, the gods seem pleased.
All right, I'm going to ask one more question, and then I'm going to open it up to the group. We've got about 20, 25 people here.
Hey, everybody.
they're handpicked. All right. Dustin tells me that you are very much a huge film fan, and I wanted to.
Who told you that?
Dustin.
I don't know who that is. Oh, that guy! Right. I don't know who that is. Dustin said what now?
Can you throw us in within this first, we were discussing basically the first seven issues, the first story arc. Are there any basically film references that we might have missed, or any basic nods or anything to any films within? I spotted one. Tell me if this is accurate. When
okay.
Pepper left the building. Okay,
uh-huh.
And the place was about to get bombed. All I could think of was Godfather 3 and the scene where basically Joey Zaza and Don Altobello
wow.
managed to get out of the building?
It's an A for effort. I only ever saw Godfather 3 once. So no, that wasn't deliberate. I can't think of. Actually, I just got the paperback. Let me flip. I should have flipped through this before we called. Let me see. I don't think so. There's nothing that immediately springs to mind as being a deliberate. I tend to be pretty deliberate when I do that stuff, and then have a pretty good recall for it. But no, it was all very nothing really that springs to mind.
You throw quite a bit of cinema things though into Casanova, correct?
Yeah. Casanova, we could talk about till the cows come home.
So
yeah,
maybe
this was much more sort of freestanding. I'm looking through it now. I'm not really seeing anything.
All right, and the last question, if nobody minds. Now this, I'd have to look through my notes, but after a second reading, I became convinced after a while that there was a substantial amount of religious imagery that you were channeling, whether intentionally or unintentionally, to the point where I looked at, honestly, everyone bear with me a minute, and Matt, I'll ask you not to blow too much my way until I get this done, but I looked at the repulsor rays in his hands, the
sure.
big thing in the chest, and I'm telling you, I saw the wounds of Christ after a certain point.
It's a little hard not to. Especially when you're dealing, nothing deliberate or overt was in the script. In fact, I really tried to stay, because we were dealing with stories about terror, as far away from deliberate religious iconography as possible. Regardless of what that religion was, there are no, even to the point where at one point we had identifiably Muslim terrorists, and I took them out. Just because it was something we had seen before, and it felt a little easy. It was really an effort to stay as far away from that stuff as possible, just so we didn't get lost up in the let's just call it emotional dogma of the world at this particular time. But again, I think it's impossible when you've got a guy with like glowing hands, like levitating. It's kind of hard not to make those visual illusions. Now, if Salva may have put some stuff in, Salva may have been thinking in a very kind of Christ-like way with some of the imagery. But none of that was from my art direction. Again, but that was a very specific choice not to.
All right, because it looked to me the last one that I saw, and I've got a note here, and I'm trying to find it desperately. But it was the point where he was going literally and he was handing the ring that was going to save Pepper's life. And just to me, it looked like, that was the host. And
right.
And literally Iron Man being the savior is saying, take this part of me and, then this will save you. And it just seems so obvious. And I mean, I thought it was tremendous. It really got me thinking. And
then, yeah, I'm a genius, man. I am a straight-up genius. Now, again, I suspect there was perhaps some staging in how Salva handled it, but again, I really wanted to be careful, especially when you've got a story about a rich white American trying to impose an ideology on the world, and the world pushing back. It's such a landmine minefield to navigate. I really tried to stay as what is. Non-secular or secular? Which one means non-religious?
Secular.
State is secular. I always have that fine. Anybody in the room watch that show Sports Night?
Yeah, that was a great show.
There's a guy, the one character mixed the two words up, and then he was convinced that he had been talking to Hillary Clinton all night about non-secular funding, and he was embarrassed. Ever since I saw that show, now I'm convinced I get the words wrong, so I freeze up whenever I have to say it. But anyway, I try to stay as a-religious as possible.
Does anyone have any questions? Go ahead. Say your name, please.
Hey, my name is Matthew, and my question is, though, what type of music do you listen to while writing Iron Man? Is there like a specific sort of style of music that you choose to write to?
Was that what kind of music did I listen to? A lot of Bach, especially the fugues, and a lot of Philip Glass. Some Kronos Quartet. Yeah, very, very sort of like math music.
You know, we were laughing because at the last group, we wanted to have some background music, and I kept trying to talk Dustin into having the unaccompanied cello suites of Bach, and we put them on, and Dustin was like, "No." Nah. And then I just love the fact that that's pretty much an underlying thing going on throughout the book, that you keep mentioning it over and over.
Yeah, it seemed like sort of music for the smartest guy in the world, you know?
I agree. So you like, we prefer Yo-Yo Ma's version here south, but Rostropovich is pretty good.
Rostropovich isn't bad. I don't have the Yo-Yo Ma, so what I don't know about a Bach, Rostropovich, Yo-Yo Ma, classical music, symphonic thought, operatic thought, or any of that stuff would just about fill the Grand Canyon. So I'll check it out. I kind of forget that. Oh, right, different guys have different takes on the same pieces. You should maybe check it out. So I'll look for Yo-Yo Ma's take.
Yeah, I won't belabor, but I really recommend if you guys go on iTunes and listen to at least the first suite, and you'll be like, oh, unaccompanied cello, this is going to be dull, and yet it really grabs you, and it's really moving.
Yeah, yeah. I will do that tonight. Hey, man.
I was wondering, how descriptive are you with coming to like the basic appearance of the characters? Like, I mean, do you have an image in your mind of how they're supposed to look? I mean, how much leeway do you give the artist to kind of create their own appearance of the characters?
It kind of depends. If it's the first time a character appears, I'm definitely fairly descriptive. Just to kind of get it's all suggested, you know what I mean? Like, it's all art direction suggestion, and I'm not going to be able to outright salve his hand, so I just kind of put my best thoughts out there and see what my collaborators come up with. If there's some kind of plot specific thing with the appearance, I'll be very specific about it. If there's some reason that a character has to look a certain way that comes up later, I'm doing I'm kind of doing like my first big event right now. I'm writing this X-Men Dark Avengers thing, and I'm halfway through the opener, and it's the biggest thing I've ever written. And there's literally at this point like 22 speaking parts, and 30 some characters have appeared, and it's very specific who is where and why and what neighborhood and who is wearing what and when. And it's a lot of like art direction work, but it has to, because there's so many moving parts. And something like Iron Man, where the cast is somewhat small, I can just kind of riff and sort of set up who looks like what in this particular scene, and then we move on. Or like Sal, apparently, is a big giant robot fan, and when I started to refer to the Neon Genesis Evangelion stuff for the Raiders, he's like, "Oh, you like Neon? You like Ava? Well, look at this and look at that." And he started to send me all these different, you know, robot pictures, and he has developed the armor himself and has all these kind of cool bits of tech that he contributes. So it's it kind of depends on the character, I suppose, and depends on what their purpose is.
There's always been a lot of talk with Gene Colan and Don Heck and Bob Layton. They are absolute masters at manipulating Iron Man's static face to show very, very subtly emotions or responses.
Right.
Now, I looked as hard as I could, and there were moments it was well done. I couldn't point it out, but did you leave notes to the artist saying, want the armor to look surprised or sad or responsive?
I tend to write more kind of physical beats. You know, there's something very vaudevillian about comics and the way that you have to kind of transmit acting. There's subtle, there's no real, it's sort of white or black, there's no real middle range, it's all, it's too subtle, it's too invisible, or it's too over the top, it's very hard to find a middle point. So I'll tend to describe a gesture with a lot of detail, and again, it's really just to get that across to Salva, or to whomever, to Terry Dodson, to to David Ajra and let them kind of stage direct as is needed. I'm big on when we see things reflected in the mask, that tends to be sort of a thing that I'll take a special note of. I'll make a special note that we can see the reflection of so-and-so here, that kind of stuff.
All right,
but a lot of that is just Salva being really good at his job.
I'm going to go for Bro again. I know I'm going to catch it for this one again, too, but I'm going to ask. The other thing I saw in the artwork, and maybe, again, I'm reading too much into it, but it seemed to me as if the artist, it was so much more fluid when, say, Iron Man, when the point of view was not from Iron Man's helmet, and whenever Iron Man was looking, whenever it was a point of view, the drawings were purposely a lot more static, as if we were looking at a computer-generated image. Is that possible, or am I just, you know...
That's a great question for Salva, who... really designs these pages pretty intensely. It wasn't anything from my direction, but I definitely see kind of what you're talking about, and he might have been doing that absolutely deliberately.
Well, my hat's off to him, and especially it culminated to me in the 7th issue where Iron Man looked so stoic and Spider-Man looked so fluid, and it was absolutely wonderful.
And I think 7... 7, 8, and then really with 9, like, I think it took us both kind of a while to find our voice on the book. I think every issue he's doing now is better than the last because he's found it. He knows he owns it. You know what I mean? I think we had some, the two of us both kind of, it took us a couple issues to find our footing and get comfortable. But now, Salvador, the work he's doing is just terrific. And I think he really, 7, 8, he really started to take ownership of it. And then by 9, I think from 9 on, every issue's been better than the last. I just got the lettering for 11, and I thought, oh, this is it. This is my favorite. This is the best issue we've done so far. But then I got the art for 12, and it's even better. So he's just he completely owns the book now. And he's a master. He's really executing, I think, some of the best work of his career.
Do you ever find yourself, because I know you're writing several books right now, and you turn around and, like, you find yourself writing to the wrong artist for a few minutes? Like, in other words, you want the X-Men to look this way, and you go, wait a minute, he's not drawing this. This guy is.
And I've been lucky enough for the last little while with my schedule to where I tend to be able to just focus on one book at a time. I think I definitely used to kind of fall into that, but now I try to keep it really compartmentalized. I've been up on my schedule, so I haven't had to like deliver work piecemeal. When I'm writing a book, that's the only book I'm physically scripting at that time, and that helps keep my head straight on it. It's really tricky with X-Men, where like I wrote in the last month, I wrote 3 different scripts for now 4 different scripts for 4 different artists. You know what I mean? In the last 6 weeks, it's a little bit for Terry, a little bit for Greg, a little bit for Yannick Paquette, and now Mark Silvestri. So it's like you could not have 4 more different artists and 4 more different script styles. So it's. But I've been lucky that it's all been individually its own thing, and I don't start another one until the one's been done.
Now, if you have an issue or a problem with, I don't know, let's just say the way a page is laid out, do you address it with the artist directly, or are you supposed to go through the editor, or does it depend
on the book? We deal with the editor. I mean, the editor and I work with 2 really tremendous editorial teams, Warren Simons and Alejandro Albona on Iron Man are just the best, and Nick Lowe and Axel Alonso on the X-Men books. I mean, make a list of 10 of your favorite comics of the last 10 years, and I'll guarantee you Axel edited at least 3 of them. So there's a tremendous team, and they're really kind of the front line of that stuff, with an eye for storytelling and clarity and all that. I tend to, it's really rare when I've got a big note. I think it's part of it speaks to the talent of the guys I'm working with. Part of it speaks to the kind of invisible editorial work that I don't see. But it's, you know, but it is really rare when I have like a, oh, hey, we need to change this shot, or this shot doesn't work. And if it happens 9 times out of 10 these days, it happens because we're just sort of behind the eight ball on a deadline issue. As sort of the artist is turning in pages in a batch and they're being lettered in a batch, and we don't really get a chance to see it until the very end. It's like, oh, this needs to be tweaked. So, and it was ritual. Like, actually, I had a thing with Salva last month, I think on 11, where it was clearly a translation issue. You know, he's he lives in Spain, and English is his second language, and goes through a translator. And there's clearly it was clearly drawn odd. Because of a translation issue. And so we were like, oh, they thought it meant, it was like I was using an idiom that didn't quite transliterate, so it was kind of like, oh, look, it's this instead of that, so we need to get this panel refixed, so we get the panel patched, you know what I mean? Like, stuff like that kind of pops up from time to time.
Hey, Matt, this is Brian. To get back to Iron Man for a minute, issue 7 was the end of the trade collection that we're looking at, and
yeah,
probably a favorite for everybody's in the room.
Oh,
could you talk about how maybe difficult that was to have to dance around some of the continuity? I mean, did you get everything you wanted out of that story, or, you know, was it easy? Was it harder? Was it as hard as we're imagining, or was it a lot easier because you're kind of in the room?
It required, I don't know how to describe it. It wasn't hard. But it required sort of extra steps to go through the Spidey office and make sure all of those parts aligned. It was just sort of expanding the editorial loop a little bigger, and they would have notes. So I would get my regular notes sort of from my editor, and then I would get notes from Steve Wacker, the Spidey guy, which were good, but they were sort of Spidey notes that I wasn't a part of because he's editing the book and blah, blah, blah. So it was perhaps a longer process. It wasn't particularly any more difficult, but it was a little bit of a longer process just to make sure that this makes sense for what their first encounter is post all of this rigmarole. Did I get everything that I wanted out of the issue? Maybe. I don't know. I don't think I feel that way about any issue that I've ever written. So. The answer to that question would always be no. It was fun. I can say this. I wanted, after how kind of oppressive and bleak and dark those first 6 issues are, and how dark this next year gets, I wanted to have like an issue of Marvel Team Up. You know what I mean? And then Big Wheel shows up. Oh, whew, okay. Just let's remind everybody just for a second that it's the Marvel U, and it's fun and funny, and these characters are great, and we love to watch them having a good time and quipping and telling jokes and. I inveterately shoehorn Spider-Man into everything I do for no discernible reason. To any chance I can, you know, I think. So I love that character an awful lot. So it was fun. I needed a fun issue. Like, I just, God, as the writer, I needed a fun issue. I needed a break from terrorism and everything else. So on that level, I had fun. And if you had fun and you guys liked it, then it sounds like we did our job.
Wow. Oh, it was magic.
I'll tell you the same thing I told you after we read the Spider-Man annual that you did, is that you need, I know you have a full schedule, but you need a Spider-Man book somewhere on it.
Well, there's 3 Spider-Man books a month being handled by a roster of incredibly talented dudes, but thanks. Like I said, I love the character, and well, he shows up in X-Men Dark Avengers for a panel, so there's a panel where there's this thing that happens. There's like an inciting incident that happens, and all the kind of where we do a page where we're touring around the world to see as how news breaks to everybody, and we see the Avengers watching it on television, and Spidey asks Wolverine, like, "Do you need to go?" Or he's like, "No." I would like to find a way to definitively explain. I mean, I actually sat there. I got asked this at WonderCon last weekend. I did the math. I sat down with what kind of an airplane the Blackbird actually is, you know, sort of like as a piece of existing real-world technology, and did the math. Like, it would take 45 minutes, like 47 minutes, wheels up to wheels down, to go from Westchester, New York, to San Francisco, California. 47 minutes. With a Blackbird, if you had that plane, you could cross that distance in 47 minutes. That's how Wolverine gets across. Now it takes him 47 minutes. I've ordered pizzas that took longer to get to me than 47 minutes. So I felt like, hey, that's great. But some guy asked, like, that stupid question. They're like, how does Wolverine rack up all these frequent flyer miles? Do you really expect that? I'm like, well, look, if you do the math, 47 minutes, sit down. Anyway, I'm a nerd. Next question.
Yeah, this is Matt Plummer. Speaking of shoehorning characters in, did you include Danny Rand as the guy that made the
maglev train?
The magnetic ring, because you thought that, well, this is the only other billionaire playboy that could have built this thing that isn't in weapons design, or were you sort of like saying, hey, here's a great guy, maybe you might want to read some more about him?
Or was Tony Stark lying?
No, Tony wasn't lying. I left Iron Fist to... Here's the thing, I wrote a book called The Order that started Pepper on the path to getting the suit. Like when Pepper was kind of not doing anything and nobody wanted anything to do with her, and they cast Gwyneth Paltrow in the movie, I was like, all right. We knew she was a part of the Order. She was going to be running the team. And then when Gwyneth Paltrow got cast, I was like, that's it. This is the road we're on. This is what I'm going to do with her. Because no one else was doing anything. So she was already part of the Order, but then like her grand scheme got mapped out for me. But then the Order got canceled, but it was okay. I ended up writing Iron Man, so I kind of got to continue my trajectory for her. So Pepper has been headed towards this since the Order. This has been in my head for a couple of years now. I wanted to see Pepper as a hero for a long time. But I was wrapping up Iron Fist, and it seemed, and I could never reconcile, especially with what happened in the Order, that Pepper would want to get into a war suit. And like I had done all the research on maglev stuff, and Danny was fresh in my mind, and I thought it was a nice bit of intra-continuity. I mean, I was setting up Ezekiel Stain and Punisher in little kind of ways. Like if for whatever reason you've read all this stuff that I've written, it all, there's these tiny little connective moments that if you choose to view them all interlinked, you can see them all interlinked. It's absolutely invisible to everybody sane and normal on the face of the earth. But there's these little moments where things link up. So I was just that. It was like Danny was fresh in my mind. He had just done all this big magnetic stuff in the book. So it just seemed like, oh, this will be great. This is a way to kind of, anything I can do to get people to look at Iron Fist, especially because I was leaving, and I think what Dwayne has done has been so terrific. It was like, I love the book. I love the character. It was fresh in my head. And hey, look, there's Iron Fist. You should go check it out. And for people who had just come out of Iron Fist and followed me to Iron Man, it was kind of a cool moment of, like I said, connective tissue maybe. Where it made the Marvel Universe feel like a universe rather than a bunch of books that aren't related.
What was it about Pepper Potts in particular that made you want to steer her on that course?
The honest answer is when I started to write Porter, my wife was pregnant. We didn't know if it was a boy or a girl. And I sat down and looked at... where things were and realized that if I had a daughter that one day I was going to have a lot of explaining to do for the state of comic books. And it's dire and and it's near offensive lack of women, of strong women characters. So I thought, well, you know, it's time to make my little pocket of the Marvel Universe not smell so much like a gym sock. Pepper's arc came out of that, and Iron Fist 7 came out of that. That specifically, I'm having a baby. If I have a girl, and I was reacting a lot to what was it? The rape thing, the DC rape thing just finished.
Thank you.
So I had kind of a, my blood was up about that, and I thought, if I have a daughter, how am I going to explain to her what I do for a living? Why am I going to have, how do I tell my daughter, well, Daddy doesn't write any girls? And you can see, too, this is carried through in X-Men, where we're really working on bringing a lot more women into the book on as good guys and as bad guys and really kind of de-dude it a little bit.
You know, I thought Maria Hill was just a goal. She was just a nugget of a character.
She's the best. I love Maria Hill.
Can you tell me where the what was the deal though with the Magnum? Did you just throw that in?
Yeah, I don't know. I just thought I imagine them as having Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell from His Girl Friday.
Aha! You did have a movie thing in there.
I suppose so. It wasn't like deliberate, like, but I mean, that kind of like back and forth, like you're the boss and you're the subordinate, but I'm going to insult you. In quite frankly a way that is fireable in any other professional environment in the world, but you keep me around because I'm your girl Friday.
The great, if you don't mind real quick, the great thing for me, when you mentioned the His Girl Friday, was one of the pivotal moments in the book dramatically where they're on a conference call like we are now, and the three of them are talking back and forth deciding to do the Code Black. I thought,
yeah.
I mean, it's like you effortlessly brought the character out of all three. I'm sure a lot of work went into it, but it was just a joy to read.
Thanks. Thank you. You know, and too, there's a Iron Man is a tripod, and Rhodey was occupied, so we needed somebody to fill the role that Rhodey fulfilled, but in a different way, that it wasn't like, oh, right, it's Rhodey, but a chick. So, you know what I mean? But there was a real value that Rhodey brought to the book and to the world, and a real purpose he served, so... How do we find a new way to fulfill that and yet bring something different? And can we get mileage out of there being two women and Tony being this, this inveterate womanizer? And how do we do this stuff? And it sort of presented a whole bunch of fun stuff. But yeah, their relationship is very much His Girl Friday to me.
That's a great movie.
And there was another, that left scene went through a lot of cuts. I don't remember. Does he make the line about supercuts? Did that make it in?
It was supercuts. Was the response to the Magnum? Yeah.
Okay. There was at first he made a something about the Indigo Girls called. They wanted their hair. Like there was, he made like a weird. You have an unfeminine haircut joke, and it just came off as like nasty and not funny in one of those sort of ways that. Certain friends might be able to mock one another in that way, but if you're just coming to a comic book cold, it would read like gay bashing. So thank God my editor was there to make me not sound like a homophobe and a bigot.
This is
awkward laughter. Awkward laughter peppers the crowd.
Yes.
Now?
Yes.
Oh. This is Daniel, and I actually had a couple of questions.
Sure.
As I was reading the book, and this kind of goes beyond the seven issues that we cover here, I was wondering if the theme of the book is why Tony Stark has to be the person who's behind the Iron Man, because Obadiah Stane was just this young punk running around blowing up stuff for no real reason, and now and he was representative of kind of the next generation after Tony Stark, and now. Norman Osborn, who was around maybe like 10, 15 years before Tony Stark, and was the guy that Tony Stark replaced in the first place, is running around with all his stuff and using it irresponsibly. And I was wondering if that was just kind of what you're going for, as long as you're writing on the book.
Tony was in a sort of unique position. When I came on the book, with sort of where he was in the universe and what kind of decisions he had made and where he was at as a character, part of it was wanting to define who he is and why he does what he does, and just kind of not lose Tony for all the decisions. I did a lot of character work, even if it was just sort of academic kind of homework for me. I always try to have a pretty good take on who I'm writing. I understand that's a subjective comment to make, but I always feel I've done my homework before I start writing someone. So part of it, yeah, was absolutely wanting to. It's a little bit like that sort of. I'm so embarrassed that so many of my references are movies, but like that sort of the Jack Nicholson thing from A Few Good Men, where that this world is guarded by men with guns on walls. Are you man enough to do it, or whatever it is? Like this is a very special kind of Looney Tune to do what Tony does. Part of it is we see a potentially rotten future and a
definitely rotten past trying to knock him off the top of the hill.
Another question?
These ones aren't nearly as deep. The Heroes Return armor showed up last issue. Is he going to be in that for a while? It's my favorite armor.
With each kind of progressive issue, he's going to be changing suits. Basically, you see him, it'll last about an issue and a half, and then it'll hop into something else. He's kind of constantly, as his intellect is decaying and his work is being completed, he keeps changing armors because he needs simpler suits. And different suits. Like he goes underwater, so there's some underwater stuff we get. We get to see him in like one of the deep sea suits, and we get to see him in the Silver Centurion for a little bit. And
would you bring back the stealth?
No, that's actually that's sort of for a plot reason. I didn't specifically. If you brought back the stealth armor, he would never be found.
True.
In my head, I need to maybe sit down and just as a moment of like, I don't know if it's like nerd acknowledgement, make it clear that that's one of the suits that Osborn has. But no, he doesn't have access to it. Otherwise, you know, I don't have a story, so he doesn't have it.
It was just a real cool cover, I remember.
It was terrific. It was great, but it was one of those like, oh, great. Well, you know, because Brian has that great shot of Norman with all of the. Billion of suits. Like, one of those suits is a stealth suit. One of those suits. Even if we can't see it, just in my head, that's why he can't disappear.
All right, one last terribly non-deep question. Happy Hogan died a couple of years ago, who was married to Pepper and was Tony's best friend. And
yeah.
Now that Tony and Pepper are, their romance is back on, is he going to be mentioned in any way? Or is he going to be an issue?
I think in... maybe issue 15. He's definitely going to be mentioned. I think it'll be issue 15. I don't have my outline in front of me, but yeah, Happy comes up soon. I loved his. I loved that issue. I loved his death. I thought that was really fantastic. I think the Knopf's run on Iron Man was really underrated and underread, and I thought that in particular was fantastic work. And I am loath to undo it, so Happy will not be coming back on my watch, but I wanted to definitely Happy comes up very soon.
All right, I've got two questions that have been requested you answer. Ready?
Okay.
And this may have been answered with the storyline following the one that we've just read, but basically I realize that you set up all the Iron Man suits in issue 6, basically, to be pretty much pawns on a chess game, right?
Right.
But the question is, and why on earth does Tony Stark have to even be in the armor anymore? Is that something that's being looked at?
I think it's we kind of see that we saw it with the Raiders where they weren't in the armor,
right?
But there's a degree of no one has yet to beat the Turing test. At least in my, I don't know, there's kind of comic book physics at this point. We're like, but wait a second, if Herbie the robot, and that's only Reed Richards, but wait, then how come, if Ultron was built, Tony, there's an essential, you know, the soul of a person can never be replicated, and Tony, kind of a critical thing for me is that it's not just that he's an inventor, but he's a test pilot. It's not just that he's rich, it's not that he's handsome and famous. It's not just that he's the guy like Howard Hughes who designs the plane. It's that he also, like Howard Hughes, is the guy who flies the plane. And Tony would, you know, be old and decrepit before he ever put the suit on. And even then, he'd remote control it until he fell apart, you know? So there's an essential part of who he is that has to get in the suit, that has to wear it, that is what Iron Man is, that it's... Otherwise, it's, you know, oh, my God, some kind of crazy RoboCop, if you will.
Did you and the artist together come up with the idea that Tony, when he lifts his headpiece, he looks like a knight?
That was Salva. That was all Salva. And I don't know if he got that from the trailer, or if that was just kind of how he did it. It is, you're right. That is what that is, isn't it? That's it never occurred to me before.
And it just fits into the chess thing so well.
It does. Wow, that's yeah. So no, that was another brilliant thing that we did totally deliberately.
All right, I've got one more. Why? All right, now why is part six titled "Irrational Actors"?
It's a military strategy term, where you speak about the world stage, and there are actors on the world stage, and there are rational actors and irrational actors. An irrational actor is someone, say, a nation state, who acts in its own best interest. That will not go to war with their neighbor, say China, because they are outgunned and outmatched, and there's no possible way that they could survive a war with China. That behavior is referred to a nation state behaving as a rational actor on the world stage. Now, an irrational actor is someone who has no trouble, like Tony, blowing up the entirety of his company to beat the bad guy. And staying someone specializing in asymmetrical terror also is said to be an irrational actor, because they don't have their post-nation patriotism. They sort of when you look into some of the tenets of fourth generation war, these are guys who will spend, you know, $20,000 to blow up an oil pipeline that will cut off all oil to their country and hurt their people, ostensibly their people, quote unquote, but they'll do it because it costs Russia $480 billion in oil profits. That there's sort of the irrationality of asymmetry in warfare. I've been reading books about war showing off title.
Does it get?
Yeah, this is Matt Plummer again. For Ezekiel Stane, when in the first issue when he was walking through the metal detector, he told the guy that he was wearing a pacemaker. Did he really have a pacemaker, or was that just him lying about some of the modifications he had to his body?
Yeah, he was just lying about the mods.
Follow up with that, if he was hit by the EMP blast and all of the internal workings of his body that were powered by the Stark technology were rendered useless, then why was his heart still going?
Well, he didn't actually have a pacemaker. He was lying.
He was just lying to get through the detector.
So he went from being a 9% of his Basil back to 70 was a normal person. Would that be right?
More or less. I mean, now, you know, it hurt him. He wasn't doing great. He wouldn't, you know, but also he'd worked some kind of, yeah, that's the easiest way to explain it. What you guys said, only pretend I said it. Right, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, that was him being a lying little jerk.
Matt, this is Lee. I was just wondering, you tell me if you think I'm wrong. Iron Man, to me, one of the biggest challenges is he can constantly upgrade his armor and sort of shoot ahead of a lot of villains he's fighting. What kind of challenge do you feel you face trying to find a foil for him, a good villain?
Good question.
Yeah, well, you know, that's very perceptive. That is a big challenge. You know, one of the reasons that we're cleaning house and getting rid of so many of the old armors is it's been, I think, an easy fallback position for we writers to say, well, the reason why every S.H.I.E.L.D. agent in the world isn't wearing an Iron Man suit is because they cost $4 billion. But then we keep showing Tony with, like, garages full of them. So part of it is the level of playing field. Part of it, so the big thing with Stane was how is this technology never been used? And again, as an irrational actor, Tony has never taken it out on civilians. So that was something we had never seen before, is what happens when you take destructive repulsor tech or whatever kind of tech it was that Stain was using and execute it on a civilian populace or an unprepared hero populace with the idea of committing high body count homicide events. And now a big part of taking this stuff away from Tony is it's more interesting to me to see Tony losing what really makes him a superhero, his mind. Kind of putting that through the paces. So without getting into kind of too much of where we're going, that's definitely a thing that makes the character a bit of a challenge to write. And always kind of a bit of a bummer on some level when, like, the smartest guy in the world can't think of anything better to do but to, like, kick the beetle in the face. Which is part of the reason that I took him out of the armor for the end of the fight, you know, for the end of the scene. Like, and it's a comic, it's a superhero comic, it's an Iron Man comic, it is kind of what it is, and I love what it is, but what haven't we seen him do before? And let's just, you know, turn it make it a bare-knuckle brawl rather than a thing about my laser can beat up your laser.
And it's really proved to be an effective end, I thought.
All right, thanks. Who doesn't want to see Robert Downey Jr. In a pair of mantis beating the crap out of a guy? All of America would show up for that.
Well, Matt, we've taken a lot of your time, and we really, really appreciate it. On behalf of our whole group, did anyone else have...
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Adam,
No worries. Everybody, make sure, I fire away.
Before this series launched, one of the things that you stated was one of your goals is to make Tony Stark a more likable person. Have you been getting the response from people that you were hoping to get?
I haven't really listened. I kind of go, I don't handle that stuff well, so I don't really go listening. The people I've met have been really happy about it. I mean, this is sort of, I said this in an interview the other day, but, you know, yeah, people who wait in line to meet me apparently like me. But the reception at shows have been really great. I just sort of making him more likable to me, or more understandably, more of a kind of, I don't know. I hope I've made him a more interesting person. I hope I've made him a more richly kind of complex person. And I hope I've maybe cast a little light on his decision-making process and who he is and kind of what drives him and why, I hope.
Well, you're making us come back for more each month, so.
I like him more, Matt.
Oh, thanks. Then it worked.
We got to thank Adam, Matt. He's been working his butt off the entire time. Like, every single time you talk, or we talk, he's sitting there arranging. He's just been fabulous. He's like a roadie.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
Hey, Matt, this is Shelton.
Hey, I know you.
Yeah. I just wanted to thank you for spending this time with us and let you know we're really looking forward to spending more time with you in a couple of months at the con.
I can't wait.
And just thank you for all you've been doing, and you've really made us proud around here. Thanks.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Dustin, anything to add?
I don't want to talk to that guy.
Hey, Matt, have you found those hotline scripts yet?
I've got them. Yeah, I did, actually.
Don't lose them.
No, I'll bring them. I got to bring them with me. I'll bring them, present them to DARP, to show this year. They're somewhere. I found them. I know that they exist.
That sounds like an auction item, maybe, or something.
My God.
Matt, this has easily been the best discussion group we've had so far. We cannot thank you enough.
Hey, thank you so much. And really, any time. I appreciate this so much. Thanks for reading. Thanks for thinking about the stuff. And thanks for supporting a great store. Appreciate it. Savor it. Well, because it's a desert out there in the rest of the world.
Thanks, Matt.
All right,
Matt.
All right, guys. I'm gonna go eat dinner. Thanks for everything. I'll talk to you guys soon, and
all right,
I'll
take care.
I'll see you guys all at the show this summer.
Alrighty.
All right. Bye, guys.
Hey, guys. Before everyone goes, big hand for Adam. Thank you, Adam. Outstanding.
One thing I'll say is, Andy, part of your
part of your questioning to Matt was about how he got started and collaborating with artists. Matt was in three panels last year for Heroes Con, which we recorded, and in two of them he goes pretty in depth to how a little bit of how he got started and how he collaborates with people. So if you go to our website and listen to the collaboration panel and to the and to the X-Men panel with him and Ed Brubaker on the phone, they talk about those two issues a lot.
And you know why I wasn't at those panels? He was working me like a god.
See, that's why we record them, so you can listen to them now.
Fantastic. And thank you guys so much for doing this. This was marvelous.
Thanks, Andy.
They're going to listen to this on our website.
This is like a dream come true. Thank you.
That was a good one, right?
So, real quick. What do you guys want to do next?
Actually, yeah, we have fraction. Y'all just can't put a bumper on.